Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The nonprofit Greater Opportunities has been hosting youth town halls to empower students to speak up to administration about concerns that matter to them. For the first part of today's program, let's revisit the work of Greater Opportunities with these youth town halls and talk with some students involved in them. Joining us in our Des Moines studio, R.J. Miller, education advocate, executive director of Greater Opportunities, Inc. RJ, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Jumi Keode is with us as well. Jumi is an eighth grader at McCombs Middle School in Des Moines. Jumi, welcome.
Hello.
RJ, let's go to you first of all to make sure we all are remembering what these town halls put on by Great Opportunities are about. You joined us back on River to River back in the summer of 2023 to talk about their use in discussing gun violence, other violence in schools, mental health. Remind us what Greater Opportunities is all about, its mission, and how these youth town halls fit into that mission.
Greater Opportunities is a local Des Moines nonprofit that combats poverty. It's about helping our underserved and underrepresented youth within the community, as well as strengthening the low-income families within the community. The youth town halls specifically are to engage students and give them a say and give them to empower their voices so they can have a say within the educational system, because we believe that they are the biggest stakeholders. They are the biggest ones to be impacted, and we want to see them successful. So whatever barriers that they have within education, be it mental health, be it poverty, be it academics, be it chronic absence, we want to see that be addressed so they can be successful.
Mm-hmm. And how many of these youth town halls have you held?
We've held four. We're going to be holding our fifth one in May 16th, to be mm-hmm. exact.
Give us a sense of what you've covered in the past before we talk about the next one on May 16th.
So we've covered, obviously, we've covered safety. We've covered mental health. And we've covered teacher diversity. Mm-hmm. Mental health has been a big priority within these last four youth town halls, though.
Yeah. Talk about May 16th. What's the focus of that town hall?
Closing the opportunity gap, because we hear a lot about closing the academic achievement gap, which I think is important. But I also think it's very important to close the opportunity gap, because we understand that some of the kids that are not doing as good behaviorally or academically, some of these things are economic. Some of these things result from a lack of access. And we want to be able to make sure that all students have the same access that every other student is able to have. We understand that the more wealthier school districts, you know, they have a better education. You know, DMPS students may not have, you know, some of the same resources and wealth that some of those other bigger school districts have. So we want to make sure that these students are empowered, that they have the same access, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And so with this youth town hall, how do you want to specifically address the opportunity gap?
We want to address the opportunity gap by essentially going to the root cause of some of the behavior issues, such as the chronic absence, the academic issues. We want to directly hear from the students that are at risk with these different situations directly, so we can address it hands on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is the opportunity gap tied to so many other things, success in the academics in the school setting, also no doubt tied to violence in schools, wouldn't you say? This is all sort of a mixed together, isn't it?
Yes, sir. And we believe that it's not a one size fits all thing. I know a lot of times people address situations like all kids are the same. And from the previous town halls that we had and outreach with students, we realized that that's not true.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with Jumi Keode. You're an eighth grader, Jumi, at
yes,
McCombs Middle School. Tell us a little bit about yourself, first of all, before we talk specifically about these town halls.
My name is Jumi Keode. I go to McCombs Middle School. I'm 13 years old.
Mm-hmm. And have you been involved in these town halls, the four previous ones, any of those?
I've been in one of them on the panel.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the one you participated in. What did it address?
It was great. Like, I really felt like I was heard, and I felt like people, like, really were interested in what we had to say, because, like, I've really never, like, felt that by adults, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it was really good to be able to have that, and I really like the things that we addressed, and yeah.
And what issues did you address on that panel?
We addressed mental health, gun violence, a bunch of things that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think, you know, mental health tied to gun violence, of course, here, how do you think this approach deals with it differently, Jumi, than what you've had up to this point? How does a town hall uniquely approach this? You said you've never had anything like that happen before. Explain a little bit more what you mean by that.
Well, you know, like,
Or jump in if you'd like to, or RJ, if you'd like to as well, too.
Repeat the question.
Just to talk about the unique approach of these, we heard from Jumi that these gatherings, they hadn't been felt before like this, giving the students the voice here. What is unique about this, and what does it trigger in the students that's beneficial?
Like Jumi just said, I think it's very important for students to be able to have a voice, because oftentimes, from what the youth tell me, they don't feel like they have a say. They don't feel like they have a say within the home. They don't feel like they have a say within the classroom. So that provides a safe space for students to be able to be their authentic selves without feeling judged or without feeling pressured. You know, some of the students that were on the panel with Jumi, they expressed themselves as far as you know, having more student clubs, you know, more black student unions, or more culturally responsive groups.
Yeah, Jumi, how did this town hall help students talk about? You talked about mental health on your panel. Is that something that students talk about amongst themselves these days? Is that easier to do these days? Less of a taboo?
Yeah, I think it is. So I don't know if it's because of the town hall, but recently my school has hired like a therapist, and like I feel like they're doing more for stuff like that. So I feel like, you know, just having a town hall where you can really say how you feel is just like helping, you know. So yeah, and I'd be seeing kids going up to her, talking to her, like it's, yeah, it's definitely helping.
Mm-hmm. I understand cell phones is in the conversations that you've had, Jumi. Tell us, What do you discuss about cell phones?
So for my school, no phones at all. And it's just not realistic. And like, you look at gun violence and all that stuff, and it's like, do you feel safe sending your kids to school without a phone? Like, no. And I don't understand why, if you have your phone out, it gets taken. Like, I don't know why. And I understand that's not for all schools, but even just for my school, like, that's not realistic, you know?
Yeah, so most of our listeners came of age, we're in the school, the middle school like you are, Jumi, before the time of cell phones. So what is the policy at McCombs Middle School for cell phones and students?
Just no phones.
Like, zero phones. What, you have to leave them at home, or do you have to put them in the locker, or what?
You can keep it in your backpack, but if they see it here, it gets taken.
Mm-hmm. And explain a little bit more about the connection of not having a cell phone to feeling unsafe. Give me a scenario where you would feel, you just would feel unsafe without your cell phone because you're not connected to whom?
Like your parents, even like the police, 911, you know, just you don't have connection to that.
Mm-hmm. And RJ, talk a little bit about that. This was part of a past youth town hall, this discussion on safety and cell phones.
Yeah, I don't specifically remember the cell phone aspect of it, but I will agree with Jumi as far as that's a safety protocol. I think students should be able to reach out and call a parent, or a parent may need to reach out to a student for emergency for any given reason. And again, I feel like that puts a student to be in a position to feel safe.
Yeah. RJ, tell us a little bit more about where you feel this, you've made headway with these town halls. If you're having students voice their opinions, it seems administration has to be listening. Are they listening? Are they accommodating?
So there's been people from the Des Moines Public School District, like leadership, that's been listening. I know the superintendent came to the last school board meeting. I know Brother Theron that's sitting over here with us. He's came and he's in charge of the recruiting and retention when it comes to teachers. When he came to one of the town halls when they discussed teacher diversity, he's been working very hard for the district to help accommodate and really advocate for those students and get more diversity when it comes to education.
Mm-hmm. What benefits have you seen, RJ?
I've seen more students that were nervous to talk, essentially. They have learned to find their voice, and not only have they found their voice, they are helping other students find their voice as well. So I don't like the Youth Town Hall, to me, isn't just an event, it's a program, because students are taking their advocacy and they're bringing it into the building, and they're redefining what classroom culture looks like. They're creating a culture or a classroom community that works for everybody. So I've been seeing progress as far as that. And I've also been seeing students bridge that gap between teacher and student. You know, typically we hear a lot of students versus teacher, but a lot of the students that have been at these town halls have been advocating for teachers to be treated with respect, to be treated with dignity, to have mental health support so they can pour into the students.
Mm-hmm. Jumi, do you agree that these youth town halls are changing the culture at your middle school?
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
How?
Because I feel like kids feel more comfortable with saying how they feel and just, yeah, being able to have a voice, you know, because mm-hmm. a kid's voice is like, you know, like, what's the word? You know.
Yeah. Right. And are all the students are on board with these youth town halls, or are there some that are kind of holding back, do you think?
Can you repeat that, please?
Are these town halls popular among all your fellow students there at Macomb's school?
I know like some of the students know about it, but I'm pretty sure I'm the only one from my school that has been invited. So, I mean, I would say not really.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, things take a while to get established. Well, Jumi Coyote.
Coyote,
excuse me. Thank you very much for joining us. You're an eighth grader at Macomb's Middle School in Des Moines. We'll talk to another student in our next section, but thank you for now.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Okay, I appreciate you as well. RJ, stay with us, Executive Director of Greater Opportunities, Inc. We'll be back with you to talk about some more aspects of this. Greater Opportunities, hosting youth town halls to empower students to speak up to administration about concerns that matter to them. We'll talk about this more when we return. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with more of River to River from IPR News, I'm Ben Kiefer. The nonprofit Greater Opportunities has been hosting youth town halls to empower students to speak up to administration about concerns that matter to them. And the first part of today's program, we're revisiting that. Last summer, we had RJ Miller on, the education advocate and executive director of Greater Opportunities, Inc., the nonprofit, to talk about this unique approach to giving students a voice in certain communities. And we are glad that RJ, along with some others, are in our Des Moines studio as well. We'll meet those others in just a moment, RJ, but I think our listeners will be interested in knowing how these youth town halls work. Walk us through an event. What happens?
Okay, so each one has been getting uniquely better and better because we've officially been doing them for a year as of last February 8th. So when we do the youth town hall, we typically have a youth moderator. We have multiple different youths on the panel. we usually have people from the audience be able to give input, typically students or other individuals that are in a position of power to be able to address some of the concerns from the students. So we typically involve legislators, school board members, members from the district, educators, and community stakeholders. And then we also allow the students to perform as well, because mm-hmm. we want to showcase their talent. So we want to be able to create an environment to where students are able to express themselves through music, poetry, dance, as well as talk about their social issues and pretty much educate the adults that are in the room.
Yeah.
Because a lot of stuff they say is educating us.
Right. How much control do the students themselves have over what they choose to talk about, how they the messages they have there, RJ?
So a couple different times we did it different. So there's been pre-selected questions for some, and then for others, they got to just talk about whatever was on their heart.
Mm-hmm. Are there contentious moments in such town halls ever? Have you in these past four?
You mean like controversy?
Yeah, where perhaps there's some heated voices that develop here and so forth.
Yes. At a couple of town halls, we've had adults trying to essentially take over the town hall and talk over the youth. So we had to politely redirect that energy and let them know that this is a youth town hall. This is not an adult town hall. This is a space for the youth. The adults are always elevating their voices. Give young people an opportunity to elevate their own voices, because part of the problem is this. So if we want to talk about violence, for example, we want to say that, you know, we wish the youth would come to us before a situation gets violent. When they try to come to the adult is always talking over them or telling them to be quiet or to go somewhere and shut up. So how should they feel comfortable bringing it to you if you're always talking over them and not giving them that space to actually, you know, express to you how they're actually feeling?
Mm-hmm. And the adults in the room, so to speak, they understand that when they're reminded of that this is a forum for student voices.
Yeah, it's only been like it happened two times that I can think of, and each of the times it's only been one person. And they were reminded respectfully, and it was business as usual.
Okay. RJ, you are there in the studio with Theron Hobbs, a recruitment and retention manager at Des Moines Public Schools. Theron, welcome to our program.
Yes, thank you very much. It's Theron, but as
Theron,
thank you very.
Theron,
that's okay.
Excuse
it's a unique
me.
Name.
All right, Theron, tell us a little bit about your background. You're not a native Iowan, I understand. How you came to work at Des Moines Public Schools?
Yes. So no, I'm not originally from Iowa. Long story short, I give a Cliff Notes version. I'm originally from New Orleans, Louisiana. Spent my time in Louisiana as well as Texas, but spent my adolescent years in California, primarily in Oakland, California. So that's what formed me as a young person. Went to college in Southern California, met my wonderful bride, moved to the Pacific Northwest in Washington State, lived there for about 13 or so years before life brought me here to Iowa. Was doing ministry in Washington State. And so at the end of the day, like, I just want to love and serve and be a support to people. And ministry has brought me out to Iowa. And when then that season of overt, you know, congregational ministry came to an end, I just want to be in a position to where I can just serve people in a way that makes their lives better. And so that brought me to Des Moines Public Schools, was first a community school coordinator for Lovejoy Elementary on the south side. Did that for about a year and a half or so, and then did the same role at McCombs Middle School as a community school coordinator. In essence, in that position, tried to serve the flourishing of our students, their families, the staff, and the overall community. And in that spot, in those opportunities, especially getting to interact with many people on a district level, I thought to myself that, yes, I definitely want to be a blessing and be a support and help the success of a school I'm serving at. But if I could do that on the whole district level, I wanted to be able to do that. And so when the opportunity came about for the recruitment and retention coordinator role, applied for that. And so thankfully, after multiple interviews, finally got that role. And then that role kind of expanded as of this past year to not only have the responsibilities of supporting the district when it comes to recruiting and retention, but also to support them when it comes to social and emotional learning as a social and emotional learning coordinator for the districts, primarily looking at how we can build up the capacity of our staff and the adults in their social and emotional learning and capacity.
Mm-hmm. Recruitment and retention of what specifically here? What do you work on specifically?
Yeah, so I support the district as a whole in different capacities. And so we have many of our hard-to-fill positions in non-school-based roles, such as our food and nutrition, so our food service workers, transportation, and custodial. And then we also look at other roles such as our associates or our paraprofessionals. And disproportionately, we tend to have a greater need when it comes to our special education associates to help our underserved and special needs students in that capacity. And then also teachers. And the teaching one has become more challenging than I think people realize. So I appreciate giving this platform because I think many people just assume that if school district, in particular Des Moines Public Schools, if we're not getting teachers, it's because we're not trying hard enough. And I think people don't understand the landscape that the teacher profession in general, that landscape looks vastly different. CBS News did a report not too long ago that showed that back in the 1970s, a little over 20% of people graduated with a degree to become a teacher. Well, fast forward to about 2021, that only represents 4% of the people who are graduating with degrees in our country. So there's a massive dip there. And there was also data that's shown that, and it's just not in the state of Iowa, but looking specifically at Iowa, there's not only been a decrease in people who finish a teacher preparation program, but there's also been a major decrease in those who are even enter into that space to get the degree. And so with that under my role, we just have to think more creatively about what does that look like to fill in those teacher gaps, both the immediate needs as well as the future needs, and be sustainable. And so some of the things that I'm looking at are our grow our own programs, which will allow opportunities for staff who are not currently teachers who say, I want to be a teacher. How can we give them access to get their teaching degree? Because ultimately you need to have a teaching degree in life license to do so, according to the Iowa Board of Education Examiners.
Right. That's a whole big conversation. Perhaps we can have it another time. That is really fascinating. Let's get back to the youth town halls. You've been involved in two, Theron, right? Two of them, right?
Yes, sir.
And what has been your involvement? What's your role been?
So the first one that I participated in was blessed to be able to serve as a panel speaker. And in that one, I definitely wanted to be able to come away and not only remind myself, but also remind our district know when we're listening to students. So it's the difference between hearing our students and listening to our students. For me, I think hearing is kind of dealing with that very, physical ability to be able to, take the audio, the sound of someone, and then know what someone said. But I really want us to listen to our students, meaning that not only let's make sure they're heard, but let's then follow up. Let's process what they're saying. So they say that there's certain ways in which they feel seen, certain ways where they feel respected, certain ways in which they feel supported, connected to, safe, and dignified. Then let's start creating very intentional, systemic, and ongoing supports and pathways and opportunities for those things to take place, because I want to be more than just lip service. I want it to be authentic, meaningful service to our students. And so that was one serve of the panel there to, also hear their need and their desire for more diversity among teachers. And then at the second panel, it was really there just kind of be of support, but just continuously hearing the different ways in which students want us to be a support to them. Because for me, students are not just merely the future, they're the right now.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of times we see them as a future, we kind of delay some of the supports. And so I want us to definitely be focused on how can we help them right here, right now.
Right, Theron. In the ways that you've been involved, what can you tell us about the progress you feel has been made in addressing mental health issues among youth, relationship skills, and so forth?
Yeah, so for me, the way in which I've been a support to that and the progress we're having is as the social and emotional learning coordinator is helping them understand that at the end of the day, relationship skills are crucial. I think for many, depending on, what generation you grew up in, you had a sentiment that felt like you didn't really need to have a relationship with your teacher. But even that, we believe is not true. When you think about some of the teachers that you're most fond of growing up, regardless of your generation, it tend to be those you had some sort of relationships, connection to. They exhibited some sort of healthy relationship skills. And so, and as I'm out recruiting too, I'm talking to soon-to-be teachers. One of the things that they want to know is not only how we're building up the relationship skills of the students to the staff, but also how we're building it up from staff to staff and staff to students. And so just building up those intrapersonal, so think about the mindsets that we have about students and how we can respect them and support them, as well as the interpersonal skills, so the way in which we speak to them, the way in which we respond to them, the way in which we engage them is very crucial. And so I'm starting to see more of an emphasis on that. And as I'm talking to district leaders, talking to school leaders, and just talking with teachers, there's more engagement and understanding the importance of that.
If you just joined us, Theron Hobbs with us of the Des Moines Public Schools, R.J. Miller of Greater Opportunities, Inc., also in the Des Moines studio with us, January Hudson, a North High School class of 2024, grew up in Des Moines. And January, welcome back to our program. You were on last summer when we discussed these town halls when they were, I guess there were just one or two of them that had taken place. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so what is your assessment of how these town halls have been going since last we spoke with you? Have you been involved in others?
Yes, I am actually the co-host. I co-host with Greater Opportunities to help get these town halls up and running. I am still a moderator for them, and I have not been on the panel since, just kind of helping it get going and helping other youth voices be heard.
Yeah. What have you learned? I imagine when you put on such a big new venture like these youth town halls, you have a starting point and then you learn from each one. I think RJ then mentioned there have been sort of changes here. What have you learned as moderator in your book? What works well to get students talking about issues that they wouldn't otherwise talk about?
I'm kind of just getting them comfortable. I know when I was on the panel, I was kind of scared to talk just because the questions that were being asked, I didn't really know the meaning to them or even how to address them in a way. So for me to kind of co-host with them, I also kind of make the questions for the youth town halls. So I kind of think of myself and how I would want them to be answered. And then I kind of apply that to the questions that are being asked on the panel so that youth that were once in my shoes could have the opportunity to feel heard.
Mm-hmm. Do you get a sense that your fellow students are speaking their minds more and more often at these town halls?
Yes, I do agree with that statement. And I know that for certain because I know like our past youth town halls, there has not been a lot of youth there. But this last town hall was definitely our biggest. Mm. We had like 5 tables of youth students from elementary to middle school to high school, and our whole panel was full of students as well.
Mm. What do you think about this next town hall? Doesn't come up until May 16th, but we talked to RJ there talking about attendance, violence, the opportunity gap, improving academics. What in particular interests you about what's been set out as a goal for that youth town hall?
What interests me is really when I kind of think of interest for our youth town halls, I think of getting everybody together and getting as much voices heard as possible, because it's not just one person who can make a change. It's everybody coming together to make a change. So in order to do that, we need a proficient amount of people to be there and just talk really so that these adults could hear us and know that we're here to stand and we're here to get our voices to be heard.
Mm-hmm. What is that like to be heard where you perhaps weren't before, you and fellow classmates?
Being heard is not only just
being listened to. I guess there was,
right,
a distinction made there, was it? I was just, Theron made that distinction. Being,
yes.
There's being heard and being listened to. Perhaps you could elaborate on the difference there.
Being heard is, okay. being heard is just, you know, sitting there and just actually taking in what we are saying and applying that to the things that we want to see changed. And being listened to is just really just sitting there saying, okay, mm-hmm, you know, going in through one ear and going out the other and not really applying it to, some of the statements and stuff that our students are making here on this panel. So I think to be heard kind of helps a lot of students just keep opening up and keep opening up, because if they're heard, then they're going to want to keep talking.
Yeah.
And they're going to know that a change is going to be made and what they are saying is actually mattering.
Mm-hmm. Theron, since you brought that up, perhaps you want to jump in on the difference there too.
Oh, yeah. No, for me, because I think about just in general. So if you were to ask someone to do something and say, take out the trash, they heard you, right? They unless they're deaf or something like that, they heard you. But the way you could tell they listened is that they actually followed up, right? They actually did what you told them to do. And so that's the same way for our students, is that when they're voicing some of their concerns, like, I don't want us to just sit there and just audibly take in what was said and be like, oh, thank you, kids, for, you know, telling us what you're feeling. It was very bold and courageous. Like, no, I want to, mm-hmm, then follow up and say, okay, here are some of the things based off what you told us. These are some of the things in which we want to do or we can do, or also be transparent. These are some things which we can't do, but how can we, you know, still do what we can? How can we make this a better circumstance for you? Because at the end of the day, we are here to serve the students. There is no school district without the students. You know, there is a whole lot of things that doesn't take place without the students. So, yeah, I want to make sure that that it's not merely we're hearing them, but that we're listening and with our actions and with our behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Theron, we have just a minute or two left, but I know cultural competency is a key part of what's happening there. Explain what that means in this context, the Des Moines public school context.
Yeah, I'll be very economic with my words. Basically, with our school district, we look at our student population, and it's the majority, and I don't like the phrase non-white, but just to simplify the language, majority of students are non-white, are melanated people. And the majority of our staff, as well as majority of our teachers and leaders, don't come from the same cultural context. So being culturally competent is understanding, like, how do they navigate this space, and how can we also leverage the assets and the many things that they bring in their humanity from their cultural lens, bring it to this school community so that way we can all learn from each other and all be better and all learn how to dignify and humanize one another in ways in which we probably hadn't before, but truly seeing all from our African, Asian, Latino, and what have you, see everybody as an asset, as a benefit to the community, and not one particular mindset and lens, which more times not typically is a very white-centered mentality. So just want to be very pluralistic in our cultural ability to see everybody as of immense value.
Yeah, Theron, perhaps you the last word here. We have about 30 seconds left. Where do you hope this will be? This experiment, maybe it's past an experiment stage, will be in a year or two, since you're still in the initial stages, Theron.
I would just like to see more adults, more families, and more staff come together and collaborate on how we can truly serve these wonderful human beings we call students in our district.
Okay. Theron Hobbs, a recruitment and retention manager with Des Moines Public Schools. January Hudson revisiting our studio, senior at North High School in Des Moines. Good luck finishing up your final year, January, and good luck with your future career.
Thank you. Thank you.
RJ Miller, always good to have you on the program, Executive Director of Greater Opportunities, Inc. We appreciate you, sir.
Appreciate you as well. Thanks for having us.
Coming up after a short break, Facing the Inferno. That's the title of an exhibition now on display at the Old Capitol Museum in Iowa City, featuring wildland fire images from photographer Kari Greer. We'll talk with her when we come back. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from The Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about The Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Facing the Inferno. That's the title of an exhibition now on display at the Old Capitol Museum on the Pentecrest in Iowa City. It features the wildland fire images of photographer Kari Greer. On March 26th, Greer will be in town in Iowa City to talk about her years of wildland fire photography. Her work has appeared in numerous publications, including Outside Magazine, National Geographic, Adventure, Wildland Firefighter, and the New York Times. Also at that event, a panel of people studying the impact of wildfire smoke on respiratory infections. I'm joined now by Kari Greer. Kari, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben.
And also with us, Charlie Stanier. He is a professor of chemical and biochemical engineering at the University of Iowa. He'll be moderating the panel discussion in connection with this event, March 26th. Welcome to you, Charlie.
Thanks for having me.
Kari, let's start with you. I've had a look at the few of the photos in this exhibition online, really powerful images. I wonder if you, for our listeners who haven't seen them yet, describe a few of the images from the exhibition that you feel best get at what you want to bring across to visitors.
What I like about the curation of the show is that it shows a broad range. So it shows big flames, smoke, and people, and firefighting activities. So it shows some air operations with helicopters and big planes. So I think it gives a good feel for the broad scope of the wildfire fighting apparatus.
Mm-hmm. Roughly how many shots, probably hard to estimate, how many shots have you taken over the years of wildland fires and over how many years?
Oh, gosh, it's hard to say, but I would say a two-week assignment will yield a finished product of 7,000 images, and that's after the edit.
And you've been contracting with the National Interagency Fire Center that's based in Boise, Idaho. They contract your work.
Yes.
How do you go about getting these images? And what in particular are you looking for?
I started out as a firefighter and transitioned over to being a photographer. And so I consider myself, when I'm out there shooting fires, basically the eyes of the firefighter. I'm the person there covering what's really going on real time. So I'm right behind them on their shoulders, looking at what they're looking at, and then backing up and getting the broad picture and trying to create the concept of the establishing shot and then all of the detail filler that tells the bigger story of the events on the line. So I sort of consider myself a firefighter photographer.
Mm. As the father of a former wildland firefighter, I know something about this, and that when I hear descriptions of it, I would think for a photographer it'd be a real challenge to capture what you actually experience on a wildland firefighting line there, the power that you are standing in just yards away in some case from, right?
Sure. I think that's part of the challenge, is culling out the excess and really trying to decide exactly what to shoot so that you get the most bang, basically. It's like so incredible. How do you get it all into one frame? I don't think it's possible, so you have to shoot a lot.
Mm-hmm. How dangerous can it be to get the right shot?
Well, I think that I stick to what the firefighters find to be safe is what I'm comfortable with in general. And firefighters are a vigilant group, so they're willing to kind of go in and go closer. I do have that drive as well. I'm realistic. I want the shot, but I don't want to pay with an injury or my life.
Right. I wonder if you can take us back to a moment and describe the type of fire you were next to that was a particularly scary moment for you and the crew of firefighters you were with.
I have one image in the show. It's of a running crown fire in subalpine fir, and the flames are about 300 feet tall, and it looks like three bubbles worth of flames rolling through the timber. Mm. And what had happened was a burn operation, which is what firefighters do to create black line to strengthen regular fire lines so that it's removed fuel between the line and the burning fire itself. So fire had been put down, but unbeknownst to us, a thunder cell was waiting in the wings, and that thunder cell moved in and came over, and it turned that fire into the raging inferno that's shown in the picture. And we were standing about 100 yards away, and the blast in front of the flame front blew back our Nomex, which is our firefighter clothing. And basically, we felt this kind of blast of heat that would burn your eyebrows. And we all just dropped to the ground. And I remember laying on the ground, taking pictures of this flame front rolling by, because it was too hot to stand up 100 yards away.
Mm. And with you, the firefighters have a sort of last-ditch kit if they can't escape a fire, right? Do you have one of those? And what is that? Describe that a little bit.
Yes, that's called a fire shelter. It's standard personal protective equipment for firefighters. We all carry them in our packs, and they are last-ditch. I just don't even think about it. It's just there in my pack.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a foil and fiberglass, I believe, laminated tent. It's like a pup tent that is open on the bottom, and you train ahead of time how to get into it and how to drop down on the ground and tuck it around yourself so that if you are in a situation where fire is going to come close to you or over you, you can get into that last ditch. But
mm-hmm.
it's one of those things you never want to even get close to that situation.
Right. But by the time you would get that out, you would be, it's recognized by firefighters such as yourself, you would be very lucky to survive a situation that was called for, right?
Right. Those situations, those are technically called entrapment situations where you're entrapped by the fire, and those are definite no-nos in the fire world. The paperwork is outrageous, and upper management gets very mad at you.
the paperwork. Funny that you should mention it that way. But anyway, before we get on to talk a little bit with Charlie here about the hazards of smoke to our health, I wonder, as a photographer, have there been situations where you want to get a certain angle on a fire? And these are huge, monstrous fires sometimes, creating their own weather systems. Are there shots where you have wanted to be in a certain position, but it's been just much too hazardous to get there, so it was kind of frustrating?
Oh, certainly. I hate missing shots. I hate losing visibility. But, you know, smoke does provide a really wonderful patina to film. It's got this look to it, and wildfire smoke has a certain color. And the photos in the exhibit, people might notice that things look a little different than normal, but that's really what it looks like out there when wildfire smoke interacts with sunlight coming through. It just has a prism effect that, refracts light off of the particulate matter in the smoke and just creates this awesome kind of filter in a way. Mm-hmm. But yes, I do get frustrated when I miss shots. I have been known to throw my hard hat in frustration.
Kari Greer is with us, a photographer specializing in wildland fire photography. As you've heard, former wildland firefighter herself. She's based in Idaho. Charlie Stanier, a professor at the University of Iowa, moderating the panelists at this March 26th event. Let's talk a little bit about the focus of the panel, Charlie. Your research, the research of the panelists, how it relates to wildland fire, smoke, and respiratory problems, our health.
Yeah, so I've been studying air pollution for 40 years now, and you can't study air pollution without understanding smoke, since that's such an important part of air pollution. The smoke, whether it's from wildland fire or other types of combustion, is not good for your lungs or your heart. And when these smoke waves come through, so Carrie's on the sending end of the fire and the smoke, and often the Midwest will be on the receiving end.
Right, hundreds of miles away. We've experienced this several times in the last few years from fires out to the west in the U.S. or Canadian wildfires can make our air here in the Midwest really hazardous, right?
Yeah, so we can get the code red for unhealthy air quality, or this summer we had an unprecedented, we hadn't had it in 20 years, sort of the hazardous air quality level where outdoor activities should be curtailed for everyone, not just for those who are sensitive subpopulations like children, the elderly, and those with pre-existing lung conditions.
Yeah. As a moderator of this panel, tell us, what are the messages or the themes you most want to explore, will explore on March 26th?
Yeah. So the panelists that we have are experts in the chemistry of smoke. And we really want to just tie in with the themes that Kari's photographs bring up about light and smoke and protecting people's health, kind of wherever the conversation goes and where the audience wants it to go, we'll have the expertise to be able to riff on that.
Mm-hmm. Kari, since you've been involved in wildland fires in one capacity or another for decades, it sounds like, this goes back to the 90s or earlier for you?
The 90s, yeah.
The 90s, yeah. How have you seen wildland fires and firefighting in this country change over the years? It certainly seems like for us, recent years, it's a massive uptick. I wonder what your thoughts are on that and why that should be. Is that climate change? Is it just the buildup of combustibles that we've had because of our policies over the decades?
Yes, I think it's both, actually. I think earlier in my career, fires were, a large fire might be 70,000 to 100,000. That would be considered a pretty large fire to go fight and would take weeks and months to deal with. Fire seasons would last from May through September. As the years have gone by, I'm seeing fire seasons starting in earlier May, running through October, November. Certain parts of the country have year-round fire seasons now. California, the Southwest, they have longer fire seasons, in my opinion. And I'm also seeing more 500,000-acre and million-acre fires being almost not common, but not unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
I think that climate change and fuel buildup are a feedback loop, basically. I think there's so much carbon in the atmosphere creating greenhouse warming that increases the surface temperature of the earth. Lightning strikes, which is the main starter of wildfire, that's going to happen, and that's a natural force. And so when you put all of that together, you're going to have probably more fires that take hold, because not every lightning strike starts a fire. In fact, it's only a small percentage.
Mm-hmm.
But when the fuels are dry and the wind is blowing and you've got low RHs, you'll see fire growth.
Yeah.
So yes, I do see an increasing trend in fire size and duration.
Mm-hmm.
And then how long they're burning over the course of the year.
Charlie, in the final minute we have here, talk about the initiative you work with, Living with Smoke, because it seems we're going to have this in our lives for the foreseeable future. What are the goals of this initiative?
Living with Smoke is a collaboration between public health, the science departments at Iowa, and engineering. And we really have three goals. One is better methods of detecting the fire and the smoke from remote sensing. The second is better understanding of the health effects of the mixture that you breathe, because it's not just particles, it's particles and different gases. And it's a challenge to figure out what's the causative mechanism that's causing these symptoms that people have. And the third is better tools to forecast the smoke for tomorrow morning, tomorrow afternoon, so we can give better guidances to schools, to camps that need to make decisions on whether to delay, cancel, just give a warning to the parents, move activities indoors, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Kari, to finish up here quickly, what do you most want those who view this exhibition of your wildland fire images to take away?
I would like them to get a feel for what it really looks like out there up close to a wildfire. I just think it's a mysterious thing. You just have no idea what it's like out there unless you get close.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like for people to see what firefighters do. I think firefighters are a proud group because they get results, you know, and they have a really strong work ethic.
Okay. Kari Greer is a photographer based in Idaho, spent decades photographing wildland fire events, and she will be on hand in Iowa City on March 26th to talk about her exhibition, now on display at the Old Capitol Museum on the Pentacrest in Iowa City. That will also include a panel discussion moderated by Charlie Stanier of the University of Iowa. Kari and Charlie, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Today's River to River, produced by Danny Gear. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.